Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, it's blocked by James. LeBron James with the rejection.
I'm not sure that
LeBron... got a 7-foot stoner that hasn't played in 2 years.
I'm not sure that LeBron was born ready for that, but I hope that you, listener, are born ready to listen to an NBA podcast, because right now I'm recording with Justin Rowan. Justin Rowan of Fear the Sword, now of the Chase Down Cavs podcast. You just listen to the intro music regardless of whether you're listening to this on his feed or mine. Almighty Ball and NBA Show or the Chase Down. That's the intro music. And I wanted to play it for my listeners too, because I made it and it's great.
It really is. And I would recommend getting at least a weekly dose of it by checking out the Chase Down. I mean, even Perfect. If you just want to listen to the first little bit of it, you can, but I'd recommend hanging around too.
So Justin reached out to me about doing a Cavs show. I agreed because of stuff like that. That transition there where he was like, just, you know, put in this plug. That was pro. That was great.
It's like butter, man. And I just missed you. I missed you. I had been on your podcast and I needed you back in my life.
Sort of like the Cavs need some defense back in their life, but
not bad.
You know, before we get started, definitely check out Justin's show. You can find both of our shows at AlmightyBaller.com, and soon you can listen to them on Almighty Baller Radio on Dash. Some people have said the times that they were going to play on their podcast, so it's a tentative schedule. I'm still working on it. So anyways, if Justin has told you through his Twitter, which is at CavsAnada, a specific time, then he's wrong, and just like wait till I'm done putting the schedule together and then listen.
See, I was already kind of one step ahead. I understood where you were at. I had mentioned that we will be available on Dash Radio. I said I believe it'll be Wednesday, but we'll have more information once it's available. So it's always better to under promise and then over deliver.
That's classic, Justin. That's pro. That's the type of thing that I'm talking about. So, anyways, getting into the Cavs defense. So I have this thought, right? Which is the Cavs are bad at defense. That's first. Okay. If you want to go back and forth about that, then like what have you been watching this whole season? Like clearly they're not good at defense right now. And I think that going into the playoffs, they'll continue to be bad at defense, and it's an issue insofar as getting to the Warriors. And then I think that they're actually particularly well suited to go against the Warriors. So that's a theory I'm working on, is that, you know, they as an NBA defense are really bad, and they're also bad against the Warriors, but they're less bad because of particular matchups.
Right. I can definitely understand that argument. Although I would counter with this, and maybe this is me being a bit of an alarmist here, but Tristan Thompson is banged up, and that's a big reason why the defense has slipped even further than it was before. Like this last month and a half, he's been dealing with tendonitis in his knee, which has caused him to have limited mobility. If Tristan Thompson can't go out on the perimeter and switch on to Steph Curry, it's over. Like that was a big part of why they won. And he's a big part of why they are able to match up well against the Warriors, because he allows them to defend almost a small ball style while still maintaining size. And if you don't have that edge, it's ugly. Like the Cavs are going to be an underdog, even if they figure out the defense to the best of their abilities and they're clicking on offense, just because the Warriors are arguably the most talented roster ever assembled. But if they're not at 100% and Tristan Thompson's banged up, they're not going to have a good shot at all.
I definitely agree with that. And I think Tristan Thompson is actually particularly important, because I think you're right. You know, I think that people who watched the finals last year saw that his particular value was the fact that he was chasing around guys on the perimeter, partially because it's like, wow, a big man who can do this, that's super valuable. But if you have LeBron James at this stage of his career, you want him basically being a rim protector, right?
Yeah. It allows him to play free safety.
Right. No, yeah, exactly. And that's why I think that the switch that they made, I think in game three where LeBron was covering Draymond, why that made so much sense is because, yeah, he's like the masthead of the Cavs defense, but at the same time, Draymond is not, I mean, as far as perimeter threats on the Warriors go, he's the least threatening. So you can play free safety, cheat off of Draymond a little bit, but still be interrupting stuff at the point of attack, right?
Yeah, and honestly, I think, and we've seen this even when the Spurs play the Warriors, I think it's a waste of your resources to use your best perimeter defender on Kevin Durant or Klay Thompson. I think you still should put him on Draymond Green, because Draymond Green makes everything work. If you disrupt Draymond Green, he's no longer going to be giving the same quality shots to both Steph and Klay. Then they have to start working for their own shots on their own. Durant's going to be a bit of a poison pill there. Like, you might just have to accept that he's going to put up points, because, like, even if you go back to series where OKC and the Spurs would play, Kawhi Leonard's playing perfect defense, but Kevin Durant's a once-in-a-generation talent. Like, he's one of the greatest scorers ever. He's still going to give you an efficient 30 points. And really, against the Cavs, I mean, LeBron's going to do the same. Like, you can make them work for the buckets, but if you can limit Draymond Green, one, it's going to get him frustrated. And if Draymond Green is frustrated, the rest of his game suffers. Two, it takes away from the other players on the Warriors. It takes away the easy shots Klay Thompson's going to get. Steph is still going to get some good looks because he's Steph Curry. He's very damn good, but it's going to make things more difficult for him.
Yeah, and it's particularly complicated because, you know, there's this whole thing about Kawhi Leonard being a negative defensive player for the Spurs this year, and people have considered the possibility that it's because they've opposing teams have found out how to neutralize Kawhi by just putting their superstar in the corner and running an offense separate, right?
Right.
But it gets complicated because if you were to do that, then Draymond out on the perimeter, you know, if you put him way away from the action, that means that he's away from the basket, and that means that he's, you know, just not as much of a threat, and the free safety thing still kicks in. But even if he was, you know, all of a sudden this amazing 3-point shooter, you're right. Like, their offense sort of flows through Draymond, partially because, whether it's because Kevin Durant can't do this or whether it's because Steve Kerr has opted not to, the Steph Curry Kevin Durant pick and roll has not been the weapon that it was advertised to be.
Right. Right. And they, well, one, they haven't used it as frequently as they should. I think it's a combination of both, which you pointed to. But yeah, I mean, they just don't run enough pick and roll. I think they still aren't 100% comfortable with the roster that they have. Like, continuity takes a lot of time to develop. It took until year three, basically, until the Cavs figured out how to integrate Kevin Love offensively. So there's going to be some hiccups there. Obviously, they're just dealing with such a high level of talent that they still have the best team in the NBA, even with not perfect continuity. But yeah, it just hasn't been as effective as it has been in the past, or as effective as it has been with Draymond Green when they run Stephen Durant pick and rolls. So I think negating Draymond is still kind of the way to go there. And it's interesting. I'd be curious to get your thoughts on this. My whole thing, the Kawhi Leonard stuff's interesting, how they isolate them. You could definitely see teams kind of take that tactic. But I still think, at least with analytics, I think we've come to a point where we capture the offensive side of the floor very well through advanced stats. Defensively, I think we might only have, if I'm being optimistic, 30% of defense captured in advanced stats. I don't think we're ever going to get more than 60%, because you're not going to understand what the player's specific assignment was on a possession, where he was supposed to be, who had broken down defensively before. There's so many factors that go into defense that you just can't possibly know, even with tracking data. I'd be interested to get your thoughts on how far we've kind of come in tracking defense, at least through analytics.
Yeah, so that's actually really interesting because the two biggest analytics, the two biggest papers that I've you know, not contributed to, but have been, I guess, consulted on and given my input, were the 2011. I knew some guys, some Harvard guys, who were working on developing a wing theory of defense based on the 2011 MIT paper that won that year, actually, the Dwight Howard effect, which is right. basically how Larry Sanders got paid. Shout out Larry Sanders, now a Cav. Right. And basically what they were trying to do is start with the idea that evaluating wing defense is hard. So instead of evaluating wing defense, you basically evaluated the wing defenders that weren't protecting the rim and then divvied it up by that and then factored in the fact that three-pointers are just going to either go in or go out, right? So you slice out a piece of the basket and you say, okay, how good is this rim protector? And then factor that into the equation, and then all the shots that go, you know, within the three-point line, if you're good at making that a low percentage shot, then you're a good defender. And that ended up going in a really good direction. It said that Russell Westbrook was really, really bad, which I think is passes the eye test, I suppose. Yes. And it was interesting insofar as it was like wing defense is hard to do. So the only way we're going to figure this out is by like avoiding the question entirely. right. So I thought that was really interesting. And the other project that I worked on at one point was basically a triangulation of wing defense that was, you know, sort of trying to make an ABC points, right? And saying that right. C was the opposing player, and then sort of using A and B to decide how much the defender should be blamed for an action happening based mm-hmm. on the angle that the basket has to those 2 points, right? So
right.
you could be further away from the opposing player, but if you're in between the basket and the opposing player, you are more to blame for that player scoring than someone who is not, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's interesting thoughts, but I mean, like you have to, it's so complicated that there's that things leak through the cracks. And I think that as far as Kawhi Leonard's defensive real plus minus, that I think that's an obvious, you know, mistake basically in the calculation. Yeah.
In my opinion, I think Kawhi Leonard is the best defensive wing that I've seen in like the post hand check era. Like, at least in terms of consistency, like it's funny, like nothing seems forced with him defensively. It's like all instinct. It flows. He's got these fast hands. He really doesn't take a possession off. He's a tremendous defender. And that's why I said, I don't think we're close to capturing the game defensively. And the best we can do is really look at the different metrics that we have, look at what it's kind of pointing towards, and then the eye test has to fill in the rest. Like, I don't think the defensive metrics that we have are answers. I think they're questions. You look and it says, okay, so-and-so has whatever value on defense. What in his game is getting that result? And it's tough too, especially with defensive real plus minus, because they don't release the formula. I always find it interesting that so many people do just treat it as gospel when the formula isn't out there. I don't know if that's just kind of my nature, that I need to know how things are calculated. Like with player efficiency rating, we know what it overvalues, what it doesn't factor in. This we have absolutely or little to no understanding of, and people just say, okay, this is the definitive thing of how valuable a player is defensively. And it's funny because like you look at certain things, you hear that it overvalues rebounding. Height is a big factor in it, which is why every center is rated as a plus defender when we know that isn't the case. And why every point guard is basically rated as a bad defender.
Unless it's Russell Westbrook.
Unless it's Russell Westbrook, because he doesn't contest shots and camps for rebounds, which inflates it.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, I think the reason I said Russell Westbrook is because I think that he Well, first, Andre Drummond and Russell Westbrook are two of the top 5 or 10 players in defensive RPM, which is, you know, I mean, it's a fundamental failing. I think that the way of working around it that I think is sort of misrepresented consistently is that it is a plus minus stat, which means that it is based on, is he on the, wait, what?
I said trash.
Well, I'm not the biggest fan of defensive RPM because, you know, I think that your fundamental point, the launch pad into this whole argument was that I basically trust analytics as far as how well of an oiled machine an offense is, you know, like I my background is analytics. And then I got into coaching and X's and O's. And if I had to choose one or the other, I choose X's and O's, but diagnostically analytics is generally better, right? Like it can look like a good offense and not be one. But X's and O's is really the way that you should be thinking about defense, because until the Krabby Patty secret defense formula is figured out for wing defense, you know, we're basically just running around like plankton. I don't know. That was iffy, but yeah, I mean, we don't know the secret sauce of wing defense. We can't quantify it, right? So you should pay attention. You should understand that Andre Drummond is not good at defense, and Russell Westbrook isn't either. But what I was initially saying with the whole plus minus thing is that any plus minus stat is going to be an evaluation of when he's on the court versus off the court, and then you just watch sub patterns and you realize that the first thing that it's like how coaching battles go back and forth. Basically, Popovich is like, okay, they have a superstar. Kawhi Leonard's sub pattern is entirely based on whether or not that superstar is in the game, right? So if he's not in the game, Kawhi's sitting. If he is, then Kawhi's not, right? And then secondarily, the opposing coach will say, okay, well, most of the time we bring our second best scorer, our Jamal Crawford or Enes Kanter or whatever, off the bench. That's what we typically do. But a lot of NBA coaches, in response to the whole Kawhi Leonard problem, will, like we've discussed, put their, you know, superstar off in the corner and then have Kawhi Leonard sort of out of the play, away from the action, basically. And then instead of bringing Enes Kanter off the bench, you run stuff through him. And what that means is that the Spurs bench looks really, really good because they don't have an offensive option on the bench, right? And I mean, that's basically the bottom line. Does that all make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. And it's funny, like, that's understanding what the rotations are and what the responsibilities are of the team is something that I think it's lost on a lot of people. Like, it's funny, I think, like, the plus minus stats are being used more and more because a lot of writers are asked to talk about basically the entire league and they have to have an opinion on everything. So I think in lieu of watching all 30 teams 3 times a week, they just look at the stats. And I think it's a lazy characterization to say that, oh, okay, all analytics people, they just stare at a spreadsheet. I love analytics. Like, I really do. I think it adds a lot. But more and more, I see hot takes that are formed not just because of the stat. The stat alone isn't a problem. It's how it's applied and how it's used. Like, if you watch the Cavs, you know that in the first quarter, LeBron James subs out early. And then to start the second, he comes in with the bench unit against opposing benches, and that's when the team typically makes a run. Now, that's made possible typically because Kyrie and Love are able to match another team's starting unit punch for punch without LeBron, or if they give up a little bit of ground, it's not going to be substantial, and then LeBron just wrecks an opposing team's bench. And when the team had their first slump, it was because that bench unit was no longer effective because they had to move Amon Shumpert into the starting lineup, which took away someone that they had in that lineup that was capable of dribbling. Then you had LeBron freaking out saying that they need another playmaker.
Marginally capable of dribbling, but continue.
I understand. Trust me, Shumpert cannot dribble well, but better than the options that they had, which is why LeBron said that they needed an effing playmaker, because Amon Shumpert, they were missing him, his mediocre dribbling ability in that lineup, because he was now the only one that could do it. So understanding rotations and what the responsibilities are, I think, is important to when you are using those stats and you're trying to dissect exactly what they mean.
Well, yeah, I mean, I basically shifted my understanding of basketball specifically because you're always sort of chasing this Krabby Patty secret formula that isn't ultimately there, because when you practically play out the game, you have to understand the X's and O's, or you just don't really understand or figure out what exactly is going on. So I was like, okay, well, you know, analytics does do all this valuable stuff and it's awesome, but in the absence of what is on court happening, it doesn't really mean anything. At least in practicality. So I agree. I was actually going to chime in when you were saying that a lot of aggregate writers who cover the whole NBA don't watch games. I was going to chime in and throw shade at Matt Moore, sort of sarcastically, because he sort of admits to doing that, right? Because that's his job. I mean, like, I try to watch every game, but I don't. So the same thing could be said about me. Shout out Matt Moore.
What I love about Matt is that he always admit his biases, and then when he is deep diving, like when he talked about the Kawhi Leonard defensive impact so far this year, he really does pour over film and stuff. So I think it's a lost art to admit that either A, we don't know, or B, we're not sure. Like, everyone seems to feel the need to always have some sort of definitive answer. And, like, for example, the Cavs defense. Do I know what's going to happen? Nope. Do I know that they flipped a switch in the past? Yep. But I don't know what's going to happen. At some point, LeBron is going to lose before the finals. I don't know if it's going to be this year. I don't think it's going to be this year. But it's probably going to be a bit of a shock to people when it does happen.
Well, I was actually just right before I started recording this episode, I was just talking on another show about Russell Westbrook and the Thunder. And part of the reason I said that I was so impressed with the Thunder is that my expectation, I was so much, most people were like, what, like 35, 40, like low 40s as far as projecting the Thunder at the start of the season. And I was like, this is a 20-win team. They're going to drop off in the same way. They're going to drop off in the same way that the Cavs did when they lost LeBron James. And my reasoning there, right, is that I looked at the situation and I was like, okay, what are they going to do? If we saw when it was just Russell Westbrook and not Kevin Durant, that the only efficient offense they could create was Russell Westbrook and Enes Kanter pick and rolls. So are you going to have Enes Kanter out there and Steven Adams? Because that's flawed in a way that we saw destroy the Pistons back in, you know, the Andre Drummond, Greg Monroe era, right? So are you going to have Enes Kanter, not Steven Adams? Now your defense is awful. And then put all that stuff aside, your clutch offense is going to be awful. Basically, bottom line, I didn't understand and didn't engross myself enough in the Thunder to understand what Scott Brooks figured out, which is, wait, we can have Russell Westbrook get the rebound and push it in transition, and that's how we'll get the 20 points that we would otherwise lose by, right?
Right.
And I just missed the boat on that. I just didn't know. I just didn't figure it out. I've had to sort of eat crow for that. But it's, you know, that's been a difficult thing to do for someone who likes to think that they know everything, for sure.
The way I like to do it is I typically present my logic and I'm loud in my opinions, but when I'm wrong, I'm going to be loud wrong. And that's something I kind of have to accept, that it's okay. I'm going to have to eat crow here. I'm willing to laugh at myself. Most people, I mean, I put the disclaimer right in my Twitter bio. The first thing it says is mostly trash. So I'm not promising more than that.
I think I take the same general philosophical stance. I mean, you know, like off of basketball and sort of just talking about everything, although it definitely does apply to basketball, I'm looking at you, Charles Barkley, having fluidity of opinions and understanding and being able to change and having malleable opinions, I think is basically fundamental as far as like, you're not a smart person if you can't shift your beliefs, like down to paradigms, right? Like, you know, I get it that it's hard to abandon the notion that you had when you were a young Republican in college that poor people are lazy and bad. I understand that it's hard to move away from that, but if you never do that because you have such a firm flag stuck into that ground, then you're basically stunting yourself cognitively and intentionally putting on blinders. And I don't think you can be a smart person and do that to yourself, Charles right. Barkley. The NBA is great right now, Charles. I love Charles, but I think that's all an act. But, you know, basically talking to Charles Barkley, the performer, if he did actually feel the way that he does, like things change, right? Like, you know, sometimes the evidence changes and the way that you deal with that evidence changes. And it will be really interesting to see what our predictions look like as far as what happens with the Cavaliers in the finals, because I'll say last year I got it wrong. I thought that the Cavs were going to lose in five.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So who knows this year?
Yeah. The way I viewed it going into the finals, and I think I went on the Warriors World podcast before the finals, I said, in my opinion, 70 times with Steph being a little limited, which we knew going in, I said, I think 70 times out of 100, the Warriors win the series, and it only needs to be one of the 30 times where the Cavs win. No matter what happens, the Warriors were the better team last year. They didn't win the finals. The better team doesn't always win. To some extent, the NBA season is a war of attrition. But you have to be pretty damn good to get yourself into that position to capitalize on those injuries, which is why I'm always an advocate for teams trying to make the most out of their window, and why I wasn't necessarily a fan of Boston staying pat and turning down just a bargain deal for Serge Ibaka and then kind of turning down deals for both Paul George and Jimmy Butler. I think you got to put yourself in the position to capitalize, because you look at Cleveland's struggles now. If Boston had traded a second round pick and Terry Rozier for Serge Ibaka, and then they traded their package of assets for Paul George, let's say, they'd be in a much better position to capitalize on the Cavs' struggles right now. Not to mention, they make themselves a more attractive candidate in the buyout market. You see all these good role players choose to go to the Cavs or whatever team because they think that they have a chance to win. You make yourself more attractive to those buyout players by saying, hey, we're a legitimate contender that's willing to spend the money to win. And I don't think Boston put out that message. It just kind of feels like they have a foot in and foot out of the door on what they want to be. They say, oh, we want to capitalize on in a few years when LeBron's no longer LeBron, basically. But at the same time, why do you sign 31-year-old Al Horford if that's the case?
Yeah, so in theory, I agree with you. I guess like in principle, I agree with you. But specifically when it comes to Boston, I disagree. That's a conversation we can have another time. Or maybe we can circle back around to it depending on where this conversation goes. But I guess in short, like I think Boston is maximizing their potential as far as, okay, if we want to build a great 2022 Boston team versus a great team now, selling out might have been a bad decision. But
for sure, I get that.
So I think there was this point in the Cavs season that was a critical juncture that I don't think is being talked about enough. It was the point where LeBron James went to Ty Lue and said, we should simplify this defense. It's too complicated. Let's just stick to fundamentals and not, you know, learn all the switches and you know, have multiple different responses to pick and rolls. That's the key thing, by the way, is that,
yeah.
Basically Thibodeau slaughtered everyone defensively for years because he trained his entire team to have five or six different responses to a pick and roll, like whether it's like icing or forcing it baseline or giving it, you know, breathing room or whatever. And then having Joakim Noah who could make that decision on a instance by instance basis. The Cavaliers aren't doing that at all. And if there's one thing that David Blatt was good at, it was being a great, nice guy. I'm just kidding. No, it was, It was the defensive structure that he put in place insofar as how we're going to defend specific actions. And so, I mean, really,
well, I got to jump in. Go ahead, please. It's important to note that David Blatt had absolutely no coaching of the defense. That was Tyronn Lue that had the schemes and coached the defense. He was an associate head coach, and that was his role.
I guess, man. So, I mean, what I was going to say is that, dude, come on now. Oh, God. Okay. Well, so first, you remember that whole...
Lue was basically the head coach at that point. Like, the team just didn't listen to Blatt.
Well, okay, so do you remember that story that came out after the Blatt firing, that Blatt had this gigantic binder full of reasons to say, hey, we should push the pace, we should play faster, and basically the team was like, we'll take it under consideration, and then like threw it in the trash?
Yeah.
Okay, so like that's how Blatt was. I mean, It would be misleading to say that I actually have ever watched a Maccabi Tel Aviv game, but it's my understanding that that's what Blatt was good at, which is, you know, just like really formulaically deciding how to do things structurally, right? I don't think that it logically follows that Blatt would have a system put in place that immediately disintegrated after Ty Lue left, because during the Blatt era, they were the sixth best defense that league, and then Ty Lue took over, and since then, they have not been a top 15. They have not been a above-league average defense, except critically, except in the NBA Finals when they were.
And part of why the Cavs fell down two games in the Finals was because they had completely changed their defensive scheme. Like, then... And I think that's what they're doing now. Like, Brian Windhorst was talking about this either yesterday or earlier today. I was listening to it today. They don't scout teams. Like, they do not game plan for other teams. That's something that they want to keep until the playoffs. They basically say, whatever, we're going to focus on our own offense. That's all they practice, is their own offense. And they have things that they want to implement defensively, but they're going to wait. And I mean, they were mostly fine last year defensively. I'm just looking up the numbers now. They were 10th. Year before, David Blatt. Wow. That's, you know what? I honestly thought you were completely right there, but the David Blatt Cavs were 20th defensively. Tyronn Lue's.
Wait. Okay, so. Like, in the season before Tyronn Lue took over?
The season that was full David Blatt, they were 20th. The season where it was half and half, they finished 10th.
Well, okay, so in that season, in the second season of Blatt, pre-Ty Lue, what was their defensive ranking?
I will look that up while we discuss other things.
Because it's my understanding that that year that they were 10th, they were better in the Blatt part than they were.
Yeah, I think they were. They definitely were. Although it is, to be fair, they did rest more down the stretch, and it's always kind of tough to gauge how good the Cavs are regular season-wise when they rest guys, and all their team stats just get completely thrown out of whack from those games.
Yeah.
Where they never lose by 40 points.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point, I guess, man. But did you hear that intro music I made though?
it was pretty good.
I guess my point is that, you know, I think that it's not. I guess I get the point that Tyronn Lue was in charge of defense, right? But there was a head coach, and then there was a associate head coach, right? Like, you know, I think that there's like a general theory of a team, and that's put in place by someone. And the fact that it changed so dynamically sort of and both emotionally and in terms of like, you know, statistics, the fact that it changed so much when there was a changing of banner indicates something to me.
Definitely. Yeah. They had a the fifth best defense prior to him getting fired. They had
so I was right.
98.7. Yep, you were right. Yeah, as I said,
weird.
Remembered it.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I said that I remembered it that way, and that's why I was a little surprised that they were so bad year one defensively, but that was a very different team.
Yeah, and you know, that we can look at this team. You know, I guess the biggest surprise to me when you think or look at the way that everyone's responded to the Cavaliers this season, and it's sort of, I guess, my bad that we didn't make this point already. You know, you look at this team and it's like J.R. Smith is dealing with like really complicated, really awful family stuff right now.
Yeah.
And it looks like his child, who was born like a bunch of months early and was in a critical condition. It looks like, I think she is going to be okay.
She had the breathing tube removed. So, I mean, both having surgery on your shooting hand and dealing with a kid that's basically on life support.
Right. And going to the hospital every day.
Yeah, that would weigh a little heavy on me. And then you got Channing Frye, who lost both of his parents within a month. Like, it's been a little brutal. And then they've just been so banged up as well. Right?
And Tyronn Lue has been dealing with, I don't know if it's back stuff, but he's been dealing with health issues this year.
Yeah. He hasn't been healthy either. He's been sick. I think it's back issues that he's had, but he's missed out on some practices, which is killer in the NBA because you really don't get that many practices in a month. You get your little shoot-arounds, but you might get 2-3 practices in a month.
Right, yeah. And so you look at these variables, right? And then you look at the construction of this team. Like, you know, God, I was talking to James Hollis the other day. Shout out the Truth Podcast, also on allmoneyballer.com. I was talking to him the other day, and I was like, you know, Kyle Korver is not exactly the best NBA defender. And he was like, oh, blah, 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 blah. Wait, no, he's not that bad. And I was like, come on, man.
No, he's not great.
Yeah, I mean, he's like 36, and you're like, sure, he, you know, a few years ago was, you know, a starter on the Hawks defense, which was like first or second best in the league, but he was the worst defender on that starting lineup, and he also is older now, right?
Yeah. He's a smart defender. He has quick hands. He knows where to be, but he has physical limitations. Like, he was a fine defender, and I feel like people do this thing where acknowledging what somebody is now, they think it's an indictment on who they were before. Like, even with coaches can get better or worse the same way players can. Like, and the league changes. Like, Doc Rivers was a good coach. I don't think he's a good coach anymore. His schemes, what he does, has not adapted to the NBA, what the game is today. Same issue happened to Mike Brown. The game has left certain guys behind that didn't adapt.
I'm pretty sure that Doc Rivers, when he was coaching the Celtics, was just an astral projection of Tom Thibodeau.
No, of Tyronn Lue.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go into
just,
the
who's just another astral there. Projection of Kevin Garnett. Area 50 what? What is it? 52?
Isn't it Area 21?
I don't know, man.
I think they're going off his Minnesota number there.
Yeah. So, and then Channing Frye is in a similar situation as Kyle Korver, except he was never a smart defender, right? He was just always not a good defender. But he is even worse than he was then. Deron Williams, not a good defender. I mean,
yeah. He's mediocre.
If you're putting aside the postseason. Postseason success, basically. There's one above average defender on this team. There's two, except one of them is dealing with issues. Tristan Thompson, right?
Really hope you're not implying that LeBron has played good defense this year.
Well, that's where I was headed with this, is that the one good defender, the one guy who could be defending better than he is, well, no, okay. The one guy who is a really good defender and isn't injured.
Yeah.
Because Tristan Thompson is a good defender, but right now he's not, I guess, right?
Or he's not able to execute their schemes. He's still playing good individual defense, but he really bails out the team when he's at his best, and he's not in position to do that.
So anyways, what I was saying is, like, you know, the one guy who could really be changing the tone of this defense is LeBron, and he's basically choosing not to. And
again.
Right. And I think everyone knows that there is a flip to be switched. And that, you know, we were talking like, okay, is this something that they can do? There's some extent where we don't even have to argue whether or not that will happen, because yes, LeBron will be a better defender than he has been thus far in the season. But the question becomes like, okay, how much of an impact, and is that impact going to be enough to put them over the edge? And that's, I don't know.
If you want to be optimistic about the Cavs defense, there's a few things you can kind of hang your hat on. One, they were playing good defense or passable defense for the first part of the year before the injury struck. Kevin Love has played great defense this year, which has been a surprise. He's been a plus defender. He's still kind of getting back into the swing of things. But if you look, he obviously has limitations. He's not a mobile defender in the pick and roll, but if you go by every metric, he's been a defensive plus this year. The Cavs have played good defense, or they had played good defense when they were healthy, in the half court, and they were a historically bad transition team. So if you want to be optimistic about what they can do defensively, it's that we know that LeBron, Kyrie, and the Cavs in general are very good at controlling the pace. That's a big part of why they match up well against the Warriors, is that in the playoffs, where the game slows down naturally, they can slow it down even further and execute well in the half court. And if they're taking away those transition opportunities where they basically bleed points, that's going to help their defense.
Would you say that if they're chasing down transition opportunities and pinning them against the backboard?
You could definitely say that. And then the other thing is just you have to assume that everyone else kind of steps up defensively in terms of effort, because it's been lacking in the past. And it really is kind of hard to rag on Kyrie and all these other guys for not consistently trying defensively when LeBron, who should be setting the tone for the team, doesn't do it either. Like, we've seen Kyrie play passable defense. I don't think anyone's ever going to mistake him for a good defender, but he plays better defense in the playoffs. We saw with Team USA, he was actually playing very good defense, obviously against lesser competition, but he is capable of playing good defense. On the Christmas Day game, you could tell that was one of the few times that they knew what the Warriors were running. They had scouted it, and he got a bunch of steals and disrupted things. These guys do have another gear. They can slow the game down, take away those transition opportunities. But as I said, if Tristan Thompson isn't getting right physically, there's a cap on what their defensive ceiling can be.
Well, so the point I was sort of working towards, and that whole discussion of multiple switches to be flipped is like pertinent, but I think ultimately falls short, because it's like, yeah, Kyrie is going to be a little bit better, everyone's going to be a little bit better, but like, you know, you're the worst defense in the league, it's not going to be enough to put you over the edge, unless you're talking about the big daddy LeBron switch. Because The thing is, last year in the finals, they were giving up like 0.8, 0.9 points in transition, as opposed to, which is like, which would be number one in the league this year. And now they're the worst in the league this year by a comfortable or uncomfortable margin, I guess. they're the worst transition.
Comfortable for the other team.
Right, right. Yeah. They are giving up like 1.2, 1.3, right? Which is bad. It's really bad. You could go on about like, well, historically, no team this bad has ever been able to do it. But, I mean, your podcast is named after LeBron James's transition defense, right? So I think that single-handedly, the bottom line is basically perimeter players dictate transition defense. And if we're saying that Tristan Thompson is going to be chasing around Kevin Durant, which hopefully he can do, he's going to be playing defense on the perimeter. And part of the reason why the Cavs were so good is because Tristan Thompson was an impact player in transition in a way that, you know, Andrew Bogut will never, ever be, right?
Right, exactly.
But really, bottom line, LeBron James was the backbone of that transition defense, because sure, you could get a three-point shot off. Hopefully it would be Harrison Barnes, because he made none of them. But you were not going to score at the rim. And if you think that you are going to, you better you know, double pump and then get blocked or something. I mean, I don't know, whatever. It's not going to happen. You're not going to finish at the basket, which takes away one of the two most efficient ways of scoring. And then the other way that I think that the Cavaliers defense is manifestly awful is in terms of half court rim protection. And then by playing free safety, LeBron can, I mean, Rudy Gobert's defensive impact is incredible. And if we're saying LeBron James can all of a sudden snap his fingers and turn into the best rim protector in the league, if that's true, which I think it might be, then now your defense has gone from like the worst. You can see how you would turn the worst defense in the league into the best, right?
Right, right.
Because those, that's the two most important factors of defense right there, rim protection and transition.
Yeah, and that's why it's so hard to analyze the Cavs is because you sit there and you're like, okay, so my case for them flipping the switch and becoming good defensively can't be based on anything that we've seen this season. You basically have to trust that LeBron James has this other gear and that the rest of the team will kind of follow suit. But obviously LeBron's the catalyst. He's top 2-3 player all time, and he's going to change things. And how much he's capable of changing things as he ages is going to remain unclear until it happens. So basically all you can do is say, this is what's happened in the past. He still looks pretty damn good right now. But you just kind of have to wait it out and see. The simple answer, and I think the only accurate answer, is we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, but we do have like a large enough body of evidence to suggest that he can do that and he will, right? I mean,
exactly.
And so,
but you can't go too confident with it, otherwise you just sound like any other fanboy, right?
Well, I'm a impartial analyst, so I can say it.
No, I'm saying how I would come across. If I say, oh no, it's going to be fine, you're going to come across as a fanboy. If you say, okay, this is what LeBron's done in the past and he's capable of doing this. Absolutely. Like that's a fair statement.
you sound like a fanboy right now, man. Thank you. Well, there's one more stepping stone though, or, you know, I'm imagining, you know, when David Blaine walks on water, those glass pedestals, you know, like, yep. Just kidding. Magic is real, kids. So there's one more stepping stone. If you don't want to, be plunged into the Vegas water and have all of your magician makeup wash off, right? I've my metaphors so far this podcast have been like off, you know, the Krabby Patty thing, and now like David Blaine. Like
the Krabby Patty was working, and then there was the awkward kind of plankton transition.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, you know, even champions like sometimes don't look great during the regular season. So yeah, there's one more step before the pitfall happens, and it's a unique step that is new to the season, which is, in the past, you know, transition threes were taken by Harrison Barnes and he missed all of them, and
woo.
Yeah, and like, you know, I think he was like 4 of 29. Basically, him hitting those shots was the difference between winning and losing that series.
Right.
Now that in transition is going to be Kevin Durant.
Yep.
And in the half court, it's like, yeah, you can affect the point of attack. Basically, if LeBron is involved in all Draymond stuff, pick and pop, pick and roll stuff, like, yeah, you can really screw with that primary Warriors thing. But basically, you remember that Memphis game where everyone was like, oh crap, the Warriors suck, and where Kevin Durant decided during the last play of the game that he was going to take on Zach Randolph like one-on-one? You remember that?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So basically, unless Tristan Thompson can deal with that, because like that was a high efficiency shot. Like, I mean, Kevin Durant, there's a reason why his basketball brain told him to do that, because like taking Zach Randolph off the dribble is like a good shot. Like, you can win a series if that's the type of shot that you're getting. In fact, that's basically Definitely. How Kyrie and LeBron won last year.
Absolutely.
So can Tristan Thompson deal with that? Because I don't think that there's anyone. Remember, Kevin Durant's 7 feet tall. Tristan Thompson is tall enough to contest him, and also could be quick enough in a way that, I mean, we've already established that Kyle Korver, Channing Frye, not going to be able to do it, right? So can Tristan Thompson teams have do had that?
Success. I think he might be able to if he's healthy. The main key is going to be throwing multiple bodies at him. Like, you're going to have to keep guys going fresh. Like, Tristan Thompson may be asked to do that in the clutch, but I don't think you ask him to do that for 48 minutes. Like, you don't do that for the entire game, because you're just going to get exposed. Like, Durant would get into a comfort zone, and I think throwing multiple fresh defenders at him, throwing different looks at him, is like the only defenders? Way that you can kind of get him off.
What defenders? Because like the only guys I think who are going to squeak into the rotation who could do that are Kevin Love and Tristan Thompson. And if Tristan Thompson is giving up shots to Kevin Durant, you can take LeBron off of Draymond and then like kill yourself that way, or you can take Kevin Love off of Iggy / Zaza and put him onto Kevin Durant. And then that's just like a worse option, and Kevin Durant will probably just get hotter.
Yeah, he'll just torch him. But I think you work Richard Jefferson into that mix. Like, obviously, when the Warriors are going small ball, that's when Tristan Thompson is going to need to do that. When they're not going small ball, you keep Kevin Love on the center, you keep LeBron on Draymond, you put whatever shooting guard you have out there. Whether that be Amon Shumpert, J.R. Smith, who hopefully will kind of return to the defensive form that he's been in the past couple of years here. But you can even go big. Like, Tyronn Lue has experimented with larger lineups where you got someone like Derek Williams, who has the kind of requisite size to be annoying. Maybe he gives you a couple hard fouls and good defense. Maybe you throw Richard Jefferson out there, but you keep a lot of guys going after him. And even if these guys don't have the length, the type of guys that we've seen effectively disrupt Durant in the past aren't necessarily these tall guys. I mean, teams have had success keeping a big on Durant when they play Golden State, but Tony Allen, even Matthew Dellavedova, guys that can get into his airspace. The guys that can get up inside of him and really kind of disrupt his airspace and bother him, that throws him off.
Well, so I think that you can't disrupt his airspace, right? He's sort of like, people have compared his game to Dirk Nowitzki, and it's an interesting comparison. Yeah,
you're not disrupting the point of release. You're right.
You basically, if you want to stop Dirk, you need to do it like the Warriors did when they knocked off that 67 win Mavs with Steven Jackson covering Dirk. Like, you want to like get him off his center of gravity. Like,
yeah, disrupt, you know, the base, not the airspace. You're right.
Right. Yeah. So
that was the wrong choice of words.
Yeah, Justin. Richard Jefferson is like an interesting possibility. Derek Williams is. If the Cavaliers like win this year, I could see like the Derek Williams thing like being like a huge reason why, you know. I could just imagine like the articles.
It's weird enough. Like, it's, if they do win, it's going to be something weird.
Well, like Dante Jones
had a weird part in it last year.
You look at Derek Williams, and like, there's a reason he was picked with the second pick of that draft. Like, he ostensibly should be able to do stuff like this, right?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
But he's got.
I think that's part of why they brought him in.
Yeah, yeah, no, and I think that honestly I can go as far as, not all the way up to guarantee, because LeBron could like get decapitated in like the like, I don't know, anything could happen, right? But
right.
Up to the absurd, I'm basically going to assure that LeBron James is going to do all of this and like do it effectively. And then it's basically up to how are you going to cover Kevin Durant? And the only thing that compellingly is an answer to me is Tristan Thompson healthy.
He has to be healthy. Like, they don't have a shot if they don't have him.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, we also didn't see Richard Jefferson coming. And if Richard Jefferson can, you remember the Christmas game where Richard Jefferson just like very obviously fouled Kevin Durant on the last possession?
Yep.
That was so bullshit. Okay. So if Richard Jefferson can like get away with stuff like that and like do stuff like that and use his sneaky veteran wiles to just like screw with Kevin Durant, then like that might work. I'm not going to give it like a strong possibility, like a fully rested, fully healthy Tristan Thompson. That's actually a really good matchup, I think. Basically saying let's play one-on-one Tristan Thompson cover Kevin Durant. I think that's great because like you don't have to make it complicated. Like you can just rely on Tristan Thompson to do what he's shown that he can be like efficacious in doing, you know, like it's something that he's shown that he can do. And that he's tall mm-hmm. enough that, particularly when it comes to Kevin Durant, like that's an interesting answer to me. But I guess the last thing that we should touch on, so two more things to touch on. I think that the Cavs' poor defense, all of this stuff is applying directly to the Warriors, and I'm still genuinely concerned about actually getting through the Eastern Conference. The LeBron flipping a switch, I think, is like a real thing, but against John Wall, that might not matter. You know, like John Wall's faster than LeBron, you know?
But
go ahead.
He can't. I'm not here. There's two teams that I would worry about if the Cavs aren't turning. If they haven't flipped the switch, the two teams that I would consider pulling off an upset are the Toronto Raptors. And then my dark horse would be the Milwaukee Bucks because they have the length. They have the ability to disrupt what the Cavs are doing offensively. I don't buy the Wizards competing with the Cavs offensively. The Wizards' defense hasn't been good. They've been a 500 team over the last 10 games. The Wizards are not clicking at the right time, and I really don't think you can build around. Like, I love John Wall. I think he's a great, great point guard. I don't think he's necessarily an issue, but with the existing roster, I don't think you can win with a offense that is just centered around one guy creating for everybody that can't shoot. Like, you can dare him to shoot and they don't have enough auxiliary playmaking to beat you. If you look back, there hasn't been a team that's won the championship with a guy averaging over 8 assists per game. There's only been one that's won a championship since the Bad Boy Pistons, and that was the Mavs in 2011. And even then, Jason Kidd changed up how he was playing in the postseason, and they were going with multiple guys initiating the offense. These offenses that are centered around one guy creating for everybody just don't work in the playoffs. I don't buy Boston's lack of rebounding. I think that's going to kill them, and I think you can scheme Isaiah Thomas to some extent, and that's why he struggled in the past. I just don't buy those teams. Toronto and Milwaukee are the two that I can see actually putting up a fight and possibly pulling off an upset.
If you had posited the question and I had answered, I basically would have said exactly what you said about the Wizards and exactly what you said about the Celtics, with one thing added to the Wizards, which is, wouldn't it be great if Markieff Morris was actually a young Blake Griffin? That would be great. But Markieff Morris sucks. I mean, like, really, when you look at the Wizards and say, like, man, they have issues, like, what you're saying is, like, Markieff Morris is, like, not a good starter. Like, Porter's great. John Wall's great. Bradley Beal's great. Marcin Gortat is great. If like they actually had a good four who could do some of the playmaking stuff, that would be awesome.
And if they had depth,
It's
okay depth, need depth, but it's not great.
What I would have added about the Celtics is that, you're just going to give up so many rebounds. You're just going to give up too many rebounds, I think. And, like, you know, the Celtics, even, like, a full operating Celtics offense is, like, not quite as good as the Cavaliers. And then Milwaukee, mm-hmm. I'm just going to dismiss. Like, I'm sorry. They're not there yet.
They aren't, but if the Cavs aren't clicking and they are as volatile as they've been recently, Milwaukee, like, I think Giannis is either the second or third best player in the East. They have tons of length. They can disrupt what the Cavs do offensively. And if the Cavs are still bleeding points, Milwaukee's the type of team that's young, confident enough to kind of capitalize on that and at the very least be annoying in this series.
Yeah, I don't see it. I think Malcolm Brogdon is, like, a good defender against non-Kyrie point guards, and I just don't see John Henson or Greg Monroe doing anything against LeBron. I just think he would eat his lunch. So I was asking is there any team in the East that, like, their strategy wouldn't just be to, like, go in and cross their fingers? Because, like, any team, right, including the Bulls, like, could win, right? Anything could happen. But, like, I mean, is there a reasonable path to victory that doesn't include, like, 500 Kyrie bricks?
You're going to need luck. Like, I don't think there is a reasonable plan. Like, I think Toronto has nice defensive versatility and they can do some things, but you would either need an injury or the team to go really cold.
You
kind of
need Kyle Lowry to go off, but, like, injury, man. It's not a great,
like,
injury.
He's coming off surgery on his shooting hand, and he's another guy that hasn't played well in the playoffs. Like, there's a lot of guys that are on these teams that have a lot of questions. Like, the Cavs obviously have questions regarding their defense, but Isaiah Thomas has never played well in the playoffs. Kyle Lowry hasn't played well in the playoffs. Like, these under 6 foot point guards, I think you can kind of scheme them out to some extent.
Well, like, do you really think LeBron could stop DeMar DeRozan, though?
No, but you kind of just let DeMar DeRozan. you let DeMar DeRozan.
No, come
take
on, like, yeah, you can. I was just kidding. Okay.
You never know. You never know. People are coming around on DeRozan. I didn't know how serious to take that.
Oh yeah, no, I was just kidding. Yeah, basically, if the Cavs lose, it'll be statistical noise. That's my thinking too. I would agree with that. Like, it would be, like, you know, it would be variance, right? Like, it would be the same thing as It would be like when the Warriors lose.
Yeah,
it'd
be like when the 09 Magic won. Even though there was a lot of PEDs involved there.
PEDs, and, like, Dwight Howard was the original Kingslayer, but, you know,
it's true.
Okay, well. And then I had one last question, but I forgot. So instead of asking that last question, I guess we'll turn it into what's your Twitter handle? Where can my listeners find you?
You can find me on Twitter at CavsAnada. Obviously, you should also be listening to the Chase Down podcast. We record basically every Tuesday, so either Tuesday night to Wednesday morning, you could check us out, as well as on Dash Radio once that is up and running, and Chris gives me the particulars there. If you care about my writing, you can find me on Fear the Sword, as well as Hoops Habit and Press Basketball.
Yeah, and for your listeners, I'm Chris Axman at Almighty Ballin is where you can find me. You can find the whole network at ABPN Radio. Make sure you go check out all of our great shows. If you're listening to this on Justin's feed, then you know how great the Chase Down is. If you're listening to this on my feed, then, like, thank you that, you know, you're doing that. but yeah, you know, all we do over at almightyballer.com is basketball, and we do it well. That's why we're going to be on Dash Radio pretty soon here, and that's why you know, Justin Rowan has joined the fold, because premier basketball mind, basketball talker, and he's not even actually in Cleveland. He does it from afar, so it's all the more impressive.
I appreciate that.
Is NBA League Pass in Canada?
It is.
Do you watch the games through a projector that is projected onto a polar bear?
No, no, an igloo. Come on.
Don't but be so wouldn't ignorant. It just go through
Don't
the glass?
Don't be so ignorant.
It would just go through that. All right, wait. I'm trying to think of an Inuit pun, but would that be insensitive?
Maybe.
Yeah. Depends
which direction you go with it.
I was going to like, I don't know. That doesn't sound like you could get Inuit. Inuit.
Let's not even get Inuit.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I appreciate it. Whether you're listening on Almighty Ball and NBA Show or The Chase Down, thanks for tuning in. And Justin, thanks for being you.
I appreciate that. Thanks for having me on, man.